right, good morning. I'm very glad to be here to tell you about gene therapy today. Gene therapy is a field that's always had a lot of promise, but it's a particularly exciting field to be working in right now because the first signs of clinical success are coming in. These therapies can actually provide some benefits to patients in clinical trials. So I'll be telling you a little bit about the what gene therapy is, the current state of the field, and then also a bit about research that our lab is doing to address some of the remaining challenges. This isn't going to be a long talk or an in-depth talk. There's going to be plenty of time, I hope, at the end for questions. So, first of all, very basic, what is gene therapy? Gene therapy is, at its most basic level, you're delivering information to cells, so information encoded in nucleic acids, such as DNA. And so the actual thing you're delivering to patients is not the drug itself. It's instructions to the cell, and the cell is told how to make the drug itself. So this is a very flexible and powerful way of delivering therapy. And it takes advantage of what Francis Crick called the central dogma of molecular biology, which is DNA makes RNA makes protein. So your gene therapy vector, and I'll explain what that is in a second, can make potentially any protein, whether it's encoded by the patient or whether it's completely novel protein that's engineered by humans. Gene therapy vectors are, it's best to think of them as miniature machines for delivering genes to cells. And many of these vectors are derived from viruses because viruses have been doing this for millions of years. That's what they do, they deliver their genes into cells. So gene therapies make use of modified vectors, modified viruses that have been engineered so that they don't replicate, and you can take out the viral genes and put in your gene of interest to deliver a therapy. However, that leads to some problems because, of course, the immune system is very attuned to detecting viruses, and that's the focus of our research. A little bit about the state of gene therapy. Right now, there's more than 300 active gene therapies being investigated in the U.S., so it's a very active field. Not a lot of people are aware of how much activity there is going on in this area. And some of the goals of gene therapy, so as you heard from Dr. Sana, hemophilia is a very good example of a disease where a patient may be missing one specific protein. So gene therapy is good at delivering those individual proteins, but that's not the only thing that you can do with gene therapy. You can also deliver other proteins, therapeutic proteins, even if they're being produced already in the patient's body. They may not be being produced in the right location or in the right amount or for the right length of time. So I have a couple of examples of those here. So one in disorders of the vascular system, like occur in cardiovascular disease, for example, or diabetes, where there's problems with circulation, sometimes you want to get extra blood vessels to grow. So you can engineer gene therapy vectors that express blood vessel growth enhancers, growth factors. And if you put these in the right location, they'll cause the growth of new blood vessels and increase the blood supply to the tissue. Another example, you can deliver anti-inflammatory proteins. So again, even if these are already produced by the body, they may not be in the right location, for example, to deal with an autoimmune disease. And finally, a very, very large class of products that we regulate is directed at cancer. And some of these vectors actually replicate inside tumors. They're designed to replicate in tumors, but not in normal tissue. Some of them express proteins that can kill tumors. Some of them express proteins that redirect the immune system to kill tumors. So gene therapy is more than just replacing individual genes in patients that have mutations. It can be used to deliver a variety of other proteins for a variety of other therapeutic purposes. So here's just a few examples of recent progress in gene therapy clinical trials. And I put these up here because there are signs of clinical benefit to patients. I don't mean to imply that all of the challenges have been met or that these are perfect yet. But just to go through them one by one, Leber's congenital amaurosis is a genetic disease where patients have progressive blindness. And delivering the missing gene back to the retina has been able to substantially improve vision in some of these patients. And there's some real interesting human interest stories here with this particular patient populations. Very small disease, like many of these genetic diseases. This one in particular has only got a few hundred patients that have this disease. But it's been remarkable to see this field come along. The second example is hemophilia, which Dr. Sana just explained. Hemophilia is a disorder of blood clotting. And this has been there's been a lot of interest in this particular disease for a long time with gene therapy, and people are finally figuring out how to deliver enough vector and how to get it to express for a long enough time and how to evade the immune system. So it's been a very gradual process, but at last there seems to be some ability to deliver enough clotting factor to have some clinical benefit. And finally, another set of trials that's been going on for a very long time in severe combined immune deficiency. This is also a very rare disorder, but it's caused by lack of a gene, which causes the immune system to not develop properly, and patients have very defective ability to deal with infections. And this is, in a way, it's a different type of gene therapy. You can actually take the patient's white blood cells out, put them in a dish, do the gene therapy in a dish, and then put the patient's white blood cells back into the patient and correct the immune system that way. So you can administer gene therapy vectors both directly to patients and also use it to treat cells ex vivo, which are then given back to patients. So I want to make the case in this talk that a lot of the reasons for the slow progress in the gene therapy field and a lot of the challenges that still remain are because of the difficulty of doing gene therapy and the need for better vectors. This is actually a very, very difficult thing to deliver genes to cells in large numbers and get them to express for a long time. How do you target the right cells? How do you get inside cells? There are barriers that the cells put up to prevent viruses from getting inside them. And how to deal with the body's defense mechanisms. So that's what I'm going to be talking about in our research. It turns out there's no one vector that works for everything. In fact, one vector only frequently works for one thing, and it doesn't work well for another. So you may have a vector that expresses well in muscle, but it doesn't express at all in liver or the retina. So scientists are studying a variety of vectors, and they're actually taking advantage of the diversity of viruses that are out there. And this is exactly analogous to what a traditional pharmaceutical company would do in searching for drugs for cancer, for instance. They go to the Amazon jungle, they get a whole bunch of plants, and they look for extracts that have activity against cancer. So what scientists are doing with trying to get more gene therapy vectors is going to a variety of clinical samples and animal samples as well, collecting viruses and then screening them to see which properties they have, which are better for transducing certain types of tissues, which are better for giving long-term expression, et cetera. And there's some very interesting stories here as well. We're not working directly on that ourselves, but this is attempts by the field to improve the stable of gene therapy vectors, stable of tools that they have to work with. So vector design is very important, as I just mentioned, and it's an iterative process. It requires a lot of preclinical research, back and forth between creating vectors and testing them out in animals, and this is what our lab works on here. And then the part the FDA gets involved as a regulatory agency is when it goes into patients. And all too often, it's found that the vector does not work quite as well as it does in animals. This is very frequent. And this requires additional learning of what went wrong in the clinical trial. You know, it's fairly uncommon for there to be severe safety issues, but it's more often the case that the vector just doesn't work well enough at all. So people learn from these experiences, and they go back and design new vectors, and then there's a new cycle through animal studies, and then back into clinical trials. So this iterative process takes a very long time. This is part of the reason for the lengthy amount of time it takes to develop gene therapies. Okay, I work on a virus called adenovirus, which causes common cold. Most people get it when they're children. And adenovirus and other viruses are very efficient gene delivery vectors. Like I've been saying, they've evolved over the millennia to deliver their genes into cells. And this is just to give you some of the examples of the intracellular barriers and the sophisticated ways that viruses have to solve these. So the virus binds to specific receptors on the surface, and it's taken up inside these vesicles called endosomes. And normally, material taken up within endosomes is shuttled to lysosomes and degraded, but the virus has a way of breaking out of these endosomes. And then it's in the cytoplasm of the cell. Now, that doesn't necessarily do any good because you need to deliver the DNA to the nucleus of the cell. But viruses don't really diffuse very well within cells. So viruses, including adenovirus, have mechanisms to bind to microtubules, which actually ferry them all the way to the nucleus, and then they can dump their DNA into the nucleus. So this is what I mean when I say that vectors are machines. These machines have very sophisticated ways to deal with the barriers that the cell puts up to prevent viruses from getting into cells. Okay, now our lab works on intravenous delivery of vectors, and what we'd like to be able to do is deliver vectors intravenously or interarterially, spread them through the entire circulatory system, and then have them targeted to whatever organ or tumor you want to target. You can imagine how good this would be, for example, for metastatic cancer, where often there's micrometastases all over the place, and it's not possible, just not possible to inject all of them individually, but it might be possible to deliver the vector through the circulatory system. This is a very difficult problem. One problem with this is that the body innately recognizes that gene therapy vectors are foreign. For example, blood proteins attack the vector, and I'll be giving you some examples of how this works. And the other problem is that the liver rapidly removes vector from the circulation. So the liver is specialized at removing viruses from the circulation. So we like to think of this as a cat and mouse game. The cat here is the innate immune system, and the mouse is the vector. And cats have an innate ability to recognize a mouse, even if they've never seen a mouse before. There's some properties of the mouse that the cat says, wow, this is really interesting. I need to go chase this thing. And so we're trying to understand with vectors, what is making the properties of the vectors virus-like that triggers the innate immune system? So in much the same way that the cat can recognize mouse-like properties. And then our strategy, once we have that knowledge of what the innate immune system is recognizing, our strategy is to either disguise the mouse and make it less mouse-like, or distract the cat or block the cat somehow, and hopefully give the vectors a chance to get to where they need to go without the innate immune system interfering with them. So one cell we've been studying is liver macrophages known as Kupffer cells, and these actually are very efficient at clearing particles from the blood, including viruses. These are called phagocytes, eating cells from the Greek, and they take up particles very efficiently. So what we've been trying to do is understand how the macrophages recognize the virus, the vector, the adenovirus vector that we're working on, and then using that knowledge to design vectors that can slip past macrophages. And one thing we've discovered, so this is just one of the mechanisms that are involved, is that there's receptors known as scavenger receptors on the surface of macrophages. And the interesting thing about scavenger receptors, they have a positively charged region up here near the end of the molecule. And it turns out that many adenovirus vectors have a negatively charged surface. Positive attracts negative, and this is one of the mechanisms that macrophages recognize adenovirus. So without knowing anything at all in particular about the specifics of an adenovirus vector, the macrophage is still able to recognize it because here's a particle with a large amount of negative charge. So one of the virus-like properties on the surface of adenovirus is negative charge. And what can we do about that? One strategy is to change the vector. So we could make the surface of the vector less negative, and some other groups have been doing that. Another thing that can be done is to coat the vector with a polymer. Polyethylene glycol is a non-reactive polymer. It can actually disguise the vector, shield the negative charge, and reduce the ability of macrophages to recognize the vector. So that's one strategy, change the vector. Another strategy is to block scavenger receptors. And we have a number of scavenger receptor inhibitors that we can inject animals with right before giving them intravenous delivery of adenovirus vectors. And here's an example where if we give the adenovirus vector alone, we get this amount of delivery of the gene. And we get about 40-fold greater delivery if we deliver a scavenger receptor inhibitor in advance. So this is just an example of the types of manipulations you can do in order to block the innate immune system and increase the efficiency of gene therapy. There's still a lot of room for improvement. So the scavenger receptors I just showed you are far too toxic to use in humans. That's not an option at this moment. And there's also many other clearance mechanisms besides scavenger receptors, and I'm going to tell you a little bit more about those. So in addition to macrophages recognizing vector directly, blood proteins also have an innate ability to recognize vectors and attack them. And some of those blood proteins are shown here. So antibodies, even if the body has never seen a particular virus before, there's antibodies known as natural antibodies, which have some very interesting properties I'll tell you about in a second. There's also the complement system. Antibodies activate complement. Complement can destroy vectors. It can block them. It can also bind to receptors on macrophages and other things. And also clotting factors, interestingly, interact directly with the vector. So once this vector is put into the bloodstream, it's not really the same thing anymore. It's coated with a whole cloud of these proteins interacting in an ecosystem, and they really change the properties of the vector for better or for worse. Now, these natural antibodies, they're very interesting. The property they recognize about the virus is its repetitive surface. So they can bind with, so they have 10, you can see they have 10 little circular portions. This pointer's not working so great anymore. But they have 10 little circular portions known as FABs on them. They all bind to the same thing. They all bind weakly to the same thing. And together, they can bind very well to surfaces that have repetitive structures. And you see the adenovirus has a very repetitive structure on its surface. It's the same protein repeated over and over again. This is another hallmark of viruses. They have repetitive surfaces. So as I showed you before, viruses have some viruses have negative surface charge. That's one property the innate immune system recognizes. Many viruses also have repetitive surfaces, and that's another property that the innate immune system recognizes. So how can we deal with this? Well, the same strategy I mentioned before, coating the vector with a polymer, is a very effective way to reduce the repetitiveness of the structure and make it less visible to these natural antibodies and complement. So I'm going to close here. I just want to summarize our research approach to improving the efficiency of gene therapy. First, we want to understand the problem. How does the body recognize viral vectors? And the parts of the innate immune system we're studying are macrophages and blood proteins. And I showed you two examples of properties that the innate immune system recognizes. One is negative charge on the surface. Another is the repetitive nature of the virus capsid. And once we have that information, we can do rational interventions to try and block the innate immune system and make it pay less attention to these vectors while we're delivering our therapy. So where possible, we can inhibit the body's defenses and also design stealthy gene therapy vectors that are able to evade these immune defenses. And that's it. I'm just put a little bit of additional information here on additional information about research at CBER, and I'll be happy to take any questions.
So you explained some about where the promising areas of gene therapy. Are there any other besides those three that you have any optimism about?
There's an awful lot of clinical trials in cancer, and there's reason to believe that some of those may be providing clinical benefit. With cancer, it's a little bit harder to tell than with some of these genetic diseases when you have clinical success. You generally need very large clinical trials in order to, you know, with a control group. A lot of these, actually all of these studies that I just told you about, the three examples on that slide, were done without controls, you know, maybe compared to historical controls. But in those diseases, it's such a dramatic phenotype that you can tell when it's providing clinical benefit. And with some of these other diseases, we're only going to know after large clinical trials have been completed. But there's reason for optimism there.
So there was a big study story last week about these switches that regulate whether genes are turned on or turned off. And I'm wondering how this may be affecting, you know, the future of gene therapy, if there's sort of been a switch in thinking in terms of, you know, how these vectors are used or how the research is going along.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of potential there. One important issue with gene therapy that I didn't go into is, especially for some of these genetic disorders, you'd like to be able to deliver the gene therapy once and then provide therapy for the lifetime of the patient. And often what happens, for reasons that aren't completely understood, is that the vector expresses well for a while and then it gradually tapers off. And in some cases, it's just not possible to administer the therapy a second time because the immune system has developed strong immunity to the vector. So I'm sure this very complicated regulation of DNA expression and 3D conformation of the DNA has a lot to do with these problems people have been having getting long-term expression, particularly of integrated vectors. So there's a lot of area for growth there.